Welcome to this week's episode of This Week in U2 History. I'm your host, Eric Shivers. On this week's show, I will review Q Magazine's December cover story on our band U2 and let you know what I read between the lines. I'll also give you my thoughts on Achtung Baby cover. Plus, we'll have Gig of the Week. So sit back and enjoy the show. Show. A few months back, news broke of Q Magazine's feature article on U2 discussing their 20-year anniversary of the release of Achtung Baby and a little look back in the mirror of life. The article came online long before the magazine hit the newsstands with its accompanying CD of Achtung Baby covers. I refused to search out the article online. Instead, I ordered my full-blown copy from U2.com and awaited patiently for its arrival on my doorstep. I received the package about 10 days ago and finally broke open the envelope this morning. This shows you how patient of a U2 fan I am. I've read a lot of the reaction to the article, but wanted to take my time and read it on my own terms. So I did that today at Starbucks while waiting on a friend. I wanted to see what all the hubbub was about, since the internet has been flowing about band breakup rumors, last albums, and possible retirement. I think I've come away with a better understanding of U2 without really rushing to conclusions. Paul Rees, the journalist who takes time to interview the band sans Larry on a bumpy flight from Dublin to London, well, you know, Larry was included in the interview as he was on family business and sort of did this interview via email. With that in mind, each member of the band spoke to the difficult time surrounding Rattle and Hum, the making of the masterpiece Achtung Baby, and the euphoria of Zoo TV. What stuck out most in the discussion is how self-conscious the band were of themselves in the 80s outside the studio. In the studio, it was a totally different beast because the walls were down and they could be themselves. Hence, Achtung Baby and the subsequent albums of the 90s eased the band from within their skin. That looseness comes across as they share a no-holds-barred insight to the poor showmanship at this summer's Glastonbury Festival. Reflection on how No Line on the Horizon became a monkey on the band's back, and lastly, the distraction of Spider-Man the Musical. Any combination of these three items would have brought a band to its knees, but it didn't for U2. They are reflective in how the greater sum, not the individual, stumbled. We owe that much to them as they are honest within themselves. As for Bono's relevancy quote, I think he's speaking in the creative terms. The album War, Unforgettable Fire, and The Joshua Tree are the most powerful records that they've recorded and relevant records as they are reflective of those times in the 80s. I will be honest and say that U2 has not written an in-your-face tune since Mothers of the Disappeared. I think that is the relevance Bono is speaking of in the comment. U2's music has moved away from the black and white visions of those albums and grown into something different musically. For me, that's okay because they're still relevant outside the band with the One Campaign, Music Rising, and donating their time and money to other needs and causes. In closing, have we heard the last note from them? Probably not. My gut feeling is U2 will know when it's time to come back. Yes, I was one of those after Zoo TV that wanted them back in the studio immediately, much like fans do today after the 2-year jaunt around the world with 360. Now, I feel as a group of fans, we should cut them loose like a string to a balloon in order to let them have some untethered freedom as we look forward to their next great creative project. How often is it that a complete album is covered from beginning to end? Rarely. But in the case of U2's Achtung Baby, us U2 fans had the fortune of having the band's idols, contemporaries, and current hitmakers take their shot at this multi-layered album, which was included with the December issue of Q Magazine. It's always interesting idea hearing someone cover a tune or two from your favorite band, but to have a complete album of covers with the likes of Damien Rice, Nine Inch Nails, and Jack White stepping up to the challenge was enticing. Well, at least until I heard The Killers, The Fray, and Snow Patrol, whose covers of Ultraviolet Light My Way, Mysterious Ways, and Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World, respectively, were nothing more than just, you know, covers, or staying within their own comfort zone. I'm not saying that these are abysmal tunes, but they don't really convince me differently than the original, so I'm going to throw them out, but the other nine tracks are solid. Depeche Mode simplifies its own style to achieve a dry version of So Cruel. I wish that they would have funked it up a bit more, but they lean on David Gahan's voice, which is really sort of the standout part of their track. Garbage's cover of Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses could have easily fit on their album Garbage 2.0. Patti Smith's cover of Until the End of the World is really paying back U2 for their brilliant cover of her tune, Dancing Barefoot. Kudos to her. When I got word of the covers list earlier this fall, I was really excited about Nine Inch Nails taking on the challenge of Zoo Station. I was expecting this sort of industrial sound to really sort of pulse from the speakers. Instead, I got more of a solemn version, which is really kind of cool, as Trent Reznor takes this song to more of an emotional level. The same can be said for Gavin Friday's cover of The Fly. Gavin leads us into the song, almost enticing us with lust in his voice, to meet that sort of harder side of the song in the middle of the tune. Gavin closes out the song and sort of escapes into like this sort of like twinkle-like star organ piano playing, which is really kind of cool. One of the real gems of this album is Damien Rice's cover of One. Damien strips the song down to its bare bones while adding the softness of his voice. He sells us this compelling story of love gained, love lost, with a wisp of doubt. There's no great crescendo as in the original tune, which makes it more of a tug-at-your-heartstrings kind of song. I'm sure Bono is saying, as he heard this, this is exactly what we were chasing in the studio, much like Las Vegas' lead singer James Allen did, by sort of dementing a version of Acrobat. James uses a distorted voice to push the narrative of loneliness beyond the limits of the original song. In my honest opinion, I think Las Vegas' version of Acrobat completely outshines U2's version. Lastly, Jack White's cover of Love is Blindness is my personal favorite in this whole collection, because Jack has a way of deconstructing the original track and putting it back together. He takes Edge's solo in the middle of the song and makes it squeaky, so much so that it's almost uninviting, and plays on the narrative about how love covers a relationship's fallibility. At points, Jack gets angry in the way he sings the song, not just for anger's sake, but at his own angst when it comes to love. We know Jack uses this style in his own work, but for all of the covers on this disc, this is the best example where the artist's style marries well to U2's narrative attack. In closing, I am impressed by the culmination of talent on this Q Magazine freebie. I just wish, in some spots, the artists got out of their comfort zone and took the song further than its original. That is neither here nor there, as the sum of the work shows Bono et al. How relevant they are, really, when it comes to influence and influenced in the ever-changing world of music. Hey, if it's the third segment of the show, you know what time it is. It's time for Gig of the Week. And this week we're going back to December 12th, 1997, Seattle, Washington's King Dome. It's the last night of the third leg of Pop Mart here in America. And what a great night it is. Shortly before the Christmas holidays, everybody's in the festive mood, especially the crew, who hoisted a Christmas tree and put it up on top of the Pop Mart arch, celebrating the coming holiday. Also, it was sort of the advent of the beginning of the internet, and there was a little group called the Wirelings, and they went on their email list and told all of those Wireling followers who were sitting along the catwalk of the stage to wear Santa Claus hats. And guess what? They did. Celebration was in such full force that when the band got to the song Even Better Than the Real Thing, those crew members who were not going on to the fourth and final stage of the tour came out dressed in those muscle shirts that we saw Bono wear so often on this tour, mimicking him and sort of poking fun at him. The town of Seattle, Washington really is close to the heart of Bono and U2, as it is the hometown for the band Nirvana. Bono always relished how great of a singer-songwriter Kurt Cobain was, and he always thought that he was the next spokesman for the following generation. That would be my generation, Generation X. He pays tribute to the band as they close out the show with the song 40. The tour now has come to the end of the third leg, about to venture on its fourth, and the band is sort of reminiscent about how this was a tour that was supposed to be. That is, it was supposed to be quite a big tour, and they felt along the way it sort of stumbled and fell apart. Although, during this leg in America, U2 played to close to 575,000 people and grossed $26 million. But as we all know, money doesn't always speak well for how the creative process works. So there you have it for Gig of the Week. December 12th, 1997, Seattle, Washington's King Dome, the end of the third leg of the Pop Mart Tour. That's it for this week's show. Remember, keep the needle in the vinyl grooves and keep on rocking. We'll see you next week on This Week in U2 History.
Listening to This Week in U2 History, brought to you by 822design.com, a different kind of design firm. Eric Shivers is the author of I'm a Fan, How I Married U2 Into My Life Without Going to the Altar, available at amazon.com. Read more about Eric's memoir at imauTwoFan.com and join the conversation. Tune in next week for more U2 History.